ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music and more.
Well, the history of Australia is something that can be told in myriad ways. There isn't just one story, and perhaps that's the problem in getting any agreed understanding of who we are and where we came from. For many Australians, the story of Australia is the story of white settlement. It starts with the First Fleet and the expansion of the new colony, the squatters, wool, wheat, gold, then Anzac Cove and into the modern era and the dismissal of Gough Whitlam. For those who came after the Second World War, it's a story of European and other cultures arriving and making a life in a new land, the migrant story. And for Aboriginal Australians, of course, it's a story entirely of something else, a story of war and dispossession and coming to terms with being evicted from your own land. And for many, of course, it depends on where you are as to how you see it. 70% of Australians live in the suburbs. We're the most suburban nation on earth. How does that square with the outback, the rocky ridges and rugged mountains and the vast deserts of the other Australia? Historian Mark McKenna has written a new book about Australia in which he asks us to think differently about the past and reflect on where we're going. He's Emeritus Professor at Sydney University and the ANU. His book is called The Shortest History of Australia, and he joins me this evening. Mark, good evening to you. Welcome back to Nightlife.
Thanks, Philip. Great to be with you again.
It's terrific to have you with us too. Where do you start? Because you have to pick a starting point sometimes, don't you?
Yeah, where do you start? I mean, I was really conscious, you know, that we've got so many histories of Australia published, general histories of Australia published in the last 10 to 15 years. And I could you kind of ran through the book that I could easily imagine in my mind's eye when I was thinking about how to do this, you know, that I could see that if I did it chronologically, that I would end up walking through those familiar landmarks that we all know. And I'd probably end up with a book that would be dominated by politicians, you know, colonial politicians, state politicians, federal politicians. So there's an assumption that if we tell the history of Australia, if we write the history of Australia even, that we're writing the history of the nation state, right? And so what I really wanted to do was to question that and say, to throw that up in the air, literally, you know, I really would love people to pick up this book and think, is this, to ask themselves, is this a history of Australia, right? So, because I really thought I had to find a completely different way to tackle it. So, yeah, you know, it's whatever form of writing you're doing, I think it's always essential to challenge the genre, try and push the boundaries, you know, into, and so what I've tried to do in this book is to keep shifting the perspective, to keep moving around the continent from place to place, right? And, you know, showing how you see Australia's history is so much influenced and impacted by where you're standing, obviously who's speaking, but where you're standing and where you're looking, where you're looking from and,
And what are you looking at? And the idea too, I suppose, that, I mean, lots of us are wedded to this, that history means it starts somewhere, then things happen, happen, then the next thing happens, and then the next thing happens after that. Well, what happened after that?
That's right.
And then it's this linear thing that starts at a place and ends at a place, and things that don't fit into the linear kind of story get cast aside. But, of course, when you start thinking about Australia, it doesn't make any sense, does it?
We're used to thinking of history as a linear thing, right? That it's a chronological, it's from one event to the next event to the next event. But of course, we live in a country where our Indigenous people don't think of that, the history in that
way.
No, not at all. And there's a wonderful example in the book that I, you know, give to show how they don't think about the past like that.
Tell me that story.
Yeah, like I was writing about, you know, working on the Second World War, right? And I was looking at the north, up in the northwest in the Kimberley, and there's this fascinating example. 1942, an Aboriginal man in the Kimberley dreams a song cycle in which he imagines Captain Douglas MacArthur, Douglas MacArthur, Second World War, US General, and Captain James Cook, right? And this becomes a dance. The local people turn this into a dance called the Captain Cook Junba, in which Douglas MacArthur and James Cook are, you know, there are actors playing these characters, And although Cook never set foot, of course, in the northwest of Australia, these two characters are seen as white fella bosses who kind of merge and become one, right? Mm-hmm. And that dance is still performed today, and it's, you know, it's been performed since 1942. And so history, as we think of it, you know, collapses into this one moment in a dance. It's fascinating. And so in that chapter on the Second World War, I bring that in, you know, to show how this, if you're up in the Kimberley, this is a way that, you know, you think about the Second World War, which is completely foreign to the way that we would normally think about it. But it's just, it's so rich and so much more interesting.
Yeah, exactly. And Noel Pearson, who has been on the program a few times, he always says there are three big stories of Australia. And, you know, this idea of his has gained a lot of traction, I think. Probably that's a good thing. He says there are three big stories of Australia. There's Indigenous history, then there's the white settler colonial history. And then there's the migrant story, and they're the three great streams which form the river of Australian history. Yep. I mean, you'd probably agree with that, would you?
I do agree with it. I think Noel, in that context, you know, when he's saying that, he's trying to address the question of the future position of Indigenous Australians in our constitution and in our nation, right? Mm. But one of the things I've learned over, you know, many years as a historian is that those three strands, right, Indigenous, let's just take the first two, Indigenous history and the British colonial experience and settler nationhood, right? Mm. The moment that the British arrive, Aboriginal history becomes part of European history. European history becomes part of Aboriginal history, right? Mm. So often, and the same applies to the multicultural experience in a way, all of these things are interconnected. So we often get caught, I think, in public debate when we talk about Australian history in the kind of balance game, right, where we're saying, oh, we've got a bit of, we've got a dark story over here of Indigenous dispossession. We've got a kind of more rosy story of multicultural Australia after World War II, right? Then we've got the British colonial thing, which can be a bit difficult. Mm. And it's as if history is sort of, you've got these different narratives on different tracks. But the truth is we have to realise that all these things are inseparable and that we have to hold them in our imagination, in tension, because they are interconnected. They're not on, it's not as if you're, you know, walking into a supermarket and saying to yourself, I'll take a bit of negative history here and I'll balance it out with a positive story here and so on. Mm. It's just simply not like that. So, you know, one of the things I'm trying to do in the book is to show how these things are inseparable. And
I understand that, because the whole problem of storytelling in Australia is, just to return to where we began, is the problem of what stories you tell. Now, you tell some great, there are lots of stories in this book which I reckon most people would not have heard. One of the stories, I remember last time you were on the program, you told me, for example, was a story which I at the time felt was incredible, and I thought, no one's ever heard this story.
Mm, mm.
The story of, well, it's a story of survival, but it's also a story of first encounters with Aboriginal people by white people, when some sailors were shipwrecked in Bass Strait.
In Bass Strait,
And they were shipwrecked near the, I think, near the Furneaux Islands, near what we That's call right. Flinders Island today.
Yeah, very close to Flinders Island. Preservation Island it was. They were wrecked, 1797. Now,
this is 1797. So 1788, of course, they're ashore in Botany Bay, and then around in Sydney Harbour. So this is
1797. So Sydney's not even, 10 years old.
It's not even 10 years old.
So
and they're struggling. So tell me what happened.
So, okay, well, all right. Are you ready?
It's an amazing story.
So it is an amazing story. It still astonishes me. Like, I mean, I think I wrote this book 10 years ago, roughly 9 years ago, and so I'm still astonished that people don't realise that it happened. So a merchant trading vessel left Calcutta on a speculative sort of trading venture to Sydney, and It was wrecked on Preservation Island in Bass Strait, because in those days, of course, they came across the Indian Ocean under the southern coast of Australia and didn't know Bass Strait existed, right? So it went underneath the coast of Tasmania, up the southern coast of Tasmania, up and then was wrecked on its, as it was heading north towards Sydney and Bass Strait.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, you can imagine, here we are, 1797, a small island in Bass Strait. The survivors stayed with the
captain. No one knows they're there. No one knows they're there.
No. And, you know, the survivors stayed on the island with the captain, Captain Gavin Hamilton. And he put 16, 17 of his best crew, which included a lot of Lascars, Bengali seamen essentially, mm-hmm. who were known at the time as Lascars. And their job was to get to Sydney, right, and get help for those down there.
He knew about Sydney because they knew about the new
colony. Yeah.
And they were
Port Jackson. They were trying to reach Port Jackson.
They were trying to reach Port Jackson because they had stuff that they could sell the new colony.
Yes, Chinese porcelain, rum. Yeah. Rum, lots of rum. So the boat with the 16 people who were meant to get to Sydney was also wrecked, right, on 90 Mile Beach in Victoria, present-day Victoria.
Okay.
And those men came ashore and they had no alternative but to head north towards Port Jackson.
How many were there?
There were 16 of them. Right. Yeah. And so...
Hang on. They're on... Many people, our listeners in Gippsland,
sure.
would know exactly where we're talking about. 90 Mile Beach in Gippsland. So they're there. No one knows they're there. This is the extreme end of the known world at this stage. And so they know about Port Jackson. They know where that is.
Yep.
But they've got no idea how to get there. So what they think? How do they think they're going to get there?
Well, they know that they have to head north, essentially, right? And they don't want to go inland because they fear they might get lost, right?
Fair enough.
So they have to walk, you know, a distance of approximately, 600, 700 kilometres, right, to Sydney, right, to Port Jackson.
So they figure out
if we just hug the coast, we will eventually get there. Which is what they were going to do in the ship, essentially, but they would have been offshore, of course, so they're just hugging the coast. But you know the one of the incredible things is, of course, they're not on a mission of discovery. You know, they're not walking this territory because they're charged with scientific exploration or some mission of the state. They're there because they're on a survival trek, and they pass through what we now know is over 10 Aboriginal countries and different language groups, and they have so many different encounters. Essentially, the short story is that they wouldn't have survived. That there were three people who reached Sydney, and those three people would not have survived without the help of Aboriginal people along the way. And a large group of the Bengali seamen remain behind near present day, just south of present day Batemans Bay, Maruya.
And they stayed with the Aboriginal people?
Yes. Well, we don't know what happened to them, but there's lots of different possible explanations for what happened to them. Some people believe that they... were sort of accepted into the kinship networks of local Aboriginal people on the south coast. Other people say, no, we don't know, essentially, and at times they were taken into Aboriginal campsites, they were fed, they were shown the way, they had an incredibly tense moment near Jervis Bay where one of the leaders of the expedition was speared.
Mm-hmm.
In the palms of his hands, and I'm pretty sure that was a ritual spearing, you know, because they could have easily killed him if they wanted to, but he'd obviously transgressed a cultural protocol or boundary, and that was a form of, I think, ritual punishment. But it's extraordinary, you know, because after a few days they run out of their meagre provisions of rice that they had with them. They're living on the fish that they can get or whatever food they can get from Indigenous people along the way. Mm. And this is a journey from essentially, you know, February through to, you know, they're taking, what, nearly 2 months to walk, right? So it's an incredible story of human survival. And so in the book, From the Edge, it's called, the first chapter is like nearly 16,000 word. you know, kind of excavation of this story and the detail of it, because I think it's really a shame that this story isn't one of our founding stories. Because
everyone thinks in a way of whites come here and then we have this totally conflicted relationship with Aboriginal people from
the
beginning.
That's right. That's
from
right.
the beginning, it's conflicted, and they're on the receiving end of it, quite frankly, because we've got bigger guns.
Yeah.
But it wasn't actually so. Not in many instances at the start.
No, not in this. Certainly not in this case. And you know, of course, they're moving through, right? They're not trying to build farms and settle homesteads, and they're moving through the country.
Mm.
But still, we don't know the way that Indigenous people perceived the Bengali seamen, for example. You know, the Lascars. I mean, that's a fascinating kind of encounter. And we also think, you know, quite naively sometimes, that, oh, when Indigenous people encounter people from outside, they're white and they're British. Well, yes, of course, yes, they were normally, but there were a lot of exceptions, and here's one big one, very early on. So it's an incredible story of survival.
It's an example of, that's right, the way that stories are cherry-picked, and we hear some and we don't hear others.
Yeah, well, we could go on for another half an hour about this one, because there's a lot more to it, but anyway.
Yeah. I know Mark McKenna is with us. He's Emeritus Professor at Sydney University. He's written a book called The Shortest History of Australia, in which, look, it doesn't start with white settlement and end with a dismissal, although actually all those elements are in there, actually.
So, in bits and pieces.
Just back to Noel Pearson when he says there are three big stories of Australia, the Indigenous story, the white colonial story and the migrant story. I mean, these are still big canvases. We were talking on the program, I was talking with Henry Reynolds recently about his book, which is A History of Australia Told from the North. In other words, when you consider the history of Australia from the north rather than from Botany Bay or, you know, John Batman in Melbourne or the Tasmanian story, of course, it's completely different.
Yeah, yeah.
In fact, it doesn't even feel in many ways like the history of our country at all. It feels like the history of another country. That's... And you've got a great example in your book about something which I think you say was the fourth most important industry at one stage,
which is the pearl industry in the north.
Tell us about that because I don't think most people know about this.
Well, it's interesting, you know, because I don't know if people remember when Prime Minister Scott Morrison said there was no slavery in Australia.
He did say that.
And immediately
people contested
it. They did, and he did apologise for that statement. Yeah. But one of the reasons he had to apologise was because that a lot of people don't realise the way that Aboriginal people were drafted, you know, conscripted, forced into the pearling industry, was literally referred to as blackbirding at the time, where pearling companies sent men out to forcibly collect Aboriginal divers to work in the pearling industry, you know, up in the northwest of Western Australia.
Because they were very adept swimmers.
They were. And actually there's a sketch in the book from a newspaper of Aboriginal divers collecting pearls up near Broome, right?
Mm.
And so the whole history of the pearling industry, it's multiracial, of course, you know. It's incredibly exploitative in terms of its relationship with Indigenous people. And, you know, I guess one of the things, again, it's consistent with what I've tried to do in the book, is to take us up to, you know, around to different points, right, on the nation. And I start the book, after all, right, with the second chapter, which is set in Arnhem Land, in Ubeer, up in the north. And you know, that's another incredible way of illustrating your point that you just raised about it. It feels different if we're in the north, right?
Mm.
Pearling's one thing. Another thing is, when you go to a place like Ubeer and you stand and you're surrounded by that rock art that goes back to the time when the Australian continent and New Guinea were one, right? Mm. And you look north across this incredible floodplain and you realise, you think to yourself, okay, you know, Papua New Guinea, Timor, Indonesia, they are closer than Sydney and Melbourne, you know? And then you think about the fact that the ancestors of today's Aboriginal people migrated across into the north. You think about the fact that archaeologists recently discovered evidence in 2017 of 65,000 years of human habitation in a rock shelter very close to Ubeer. And you start to realise then, well, you know, you ask yourself, where does Australian history begin? It does not begin in the southeast corner where we've been thinking that it, you know, traditionally that's where it begins. Mm. It begins in the north. The north of Australia is, if we're really inclusive in our vision of what Australian history is, then it does not begin in the southeast corner. It begins in the north of the continent. And that also points to our region, right? Because when you're looking north from those places up there, you're embedded in the region that we live in. Visually, you're looking in that direction, right? And it's close. It's really close. You can feel it. And so I think that at the moment, you know, we're living in a time, from my kind of, you know, recollection memory, where I've never seen US politics dominate Australian media and culture
in
the way that it does now. And I really think that in so many ways we still tend to leapfrog, you know, over our own region. And here I am saying that on the very day that the Albanese government signed a defence treaty with Indonesia out of the, you know, unexpectedly. But, yeah, you know, and Albanese visited Indonesia. First, soon after he was elected, he went straight to Indonesia as a sign, right? But that gets dwarfed by our constant, you know, debate about Trump and AUKUS and so on in the US, as if we're kind of paralyzed in that old colonial friends kind of, you know, discussion and relationship. So I think we've still got some distance to travel, right, in really seeing and embedding, accepting the fact that the North is where country's history starts, I should say, yeah.
One of the points we're talking about with Henry, Mark McKenna's my guest tonight. We're talking about his book, The Shortest History of Australia, and the way you can think about Australia and stories you might tell. Someone says, cut to the chase, please. Were they rescued? Three of them managed to get to.
Yeah, they did, and the reason was they were rescued by fishermen just south of Sydney at a beach, Guatemala Beach, which is in the current Royal National Park,
I think.
So they were rescued there and then brought to Sydney. And one of them, William Clark, went back to Calcutta and died in Calcutta early 1800s. The captain of the ship who was waiting on the island, Gavin Hamilton, and the survivors were rescued and brought to Sydney, but Hamilton died shortly afterwards. So... and the rum, which was down on the island, well, he had to move it to another smaller island, which is now called Rum Island. He had to move it there because he was worried about people trying to access that particular cargo. And there's another side story to
this. What happened to the rum?
I got back to Port Jackson, but another, like, quite amusing side story to this is that a group of Irish convicts heard the rumours after those three people reached Sydney, they heard the rumours of this cargo of rum that was down south, right?
Mythical
so
cargo.
They stole a boat somewhere on the Parramatta River and headed south and, of course, didn't make it and were picked up by George Bass, he couldn't put all of them on his boat and they had to try and walk to Sydney eventually from down near Wilson's Promontory, right? So it's got so many side stories to it.
And it's the subject of another book, but it's an example of what, as I say, of stories we do not hear about. Look, just back on the north of Australia, as you say, this is where Australian history began. That's what we're talking about.
Yeah.
But of course, that's the other thing about the history of Australia. It's just, you know, it depends on what, as you say, what you want to look at
And I think that's
tell me about Captain Cook. Cook become such a, I don't know, it's almost as though he gets co-opted into whatever cause you want.
Well,
he's either a villain or a saint or...
What's the
best way to look at him, to think of him?
Well, firstly, I think it's really interesting that Cook is the person and not Philip, who's really got so much more presence in our imagination, right, when we think of our European history. It's Cook is the guy, right? Yeah. It's not Philip so much, it's Cook. And, you know, I think there's lots of really interesting reasons for that because Cook's free of the whole question of convictism.
Yeah.
He's the man who does take possession of the east coast of Australia, up on Possession Island, in the north of Australia, right, in 1770. So he is, of course, very much related to the question of the dispossession of Indigenous Australia. But, You know, he was, of course, lionized by White Australia, you know, from up until at least 1970, when it became contested after 200 years, when the Queen was there at Botany Bay and so on, and there were Aboriginal protesters. But, you know, it's really fascinating to look at the way, which alludes to that earlier story in the Kimberley, you know, the way that Indigenous people see Cook is that Cook is just basically a synonym for every British person.
Right.
Around the country. So Cook appears in all parts of Australia in a lot of Indigenous oral history.
Does he?
Yeah, he's there. He is every British person, right? Cook becomes all of Britain. And so again, he's not located in a particular place. He moves about according to Aboriginal people's histories of their experience of colonisation. He represents that ultimate figure of the white fella boss. And it's so, yeah, and I think we can't escape Cook. we're stuck with him, and as much as, you know...
Well, people get very head up about him, though, don't they, in ways that I've always thought was unnecessary.
Well, I think that's because for so many, for certainly older generations of Australians, we were taught that Australian history begins with Cook.
Begins with Cook,
you know, and so, you know, he is a figure, and it has become a figure. The statues of Cook and so on, you know, which has become even more divisive. But yes, generations were taught that that's where history began, and there's still a sense of attachment to that idea. And of course, Cook, you know, Cook was a brilliant navigator. Cook achieved, so if you look at the history of the Endeavour and that journey alone,
it's an
extraordinary feat. And so, you know, that what he achieved and where he came from, you know, was an incredible feat of navigational skills, seamanship, management, you know, all sort, you name it. So he's an incredibly inspiring figure in so many ways. So, as I say, we can't escape him, and we shouldn't simplify him either way. We shouldn't simplify
him. It's almost as though we're kind of unhappy to accept both of these stories in our head at the same time. We just want,
yes, that's right.
We just want the one story.
That's it. We keep wanting that one story, right? And I think that's the mistake. We have to be able to see that these things are, they're just simply not a straightforward narrative, good, bad, etc. They're very mixed.
You got an interesting piece in the book about the way that people have come to see the way Aboriginal people see the land through Aboriginal art.
Yeah, yeah.
Which is interesting. And this thing hadn't occurred to me until you wrote about it in your book. As you say, this Aboriginal art thing is incredibly new, of course. It's extraordinarily recent.
It is.
Less than 50 years old.
That's right. Yeah, yeah. And yet
it has had an extraordinary influence on changing people's attitudes to the way that Indigenous people might see the landscape.
Oh, definitely. I mean, you walk into any major building, downtown Sydney, Melbourne, Brisbane, whatever, you will find Aboriginal art, right?
Yeah.
And 50 years ago, for example, as I say in the book, you know, fundamental texts on Australian art, Robert Hughes, The Art of Australia, you know, had no entry for Aboriginal art
The
index, right? And now we've gone from that to this incredible explosion where so many people in Australia have Aboriginal art hanging in their homes. Mm. And just on this issue, you know, like I got an interesting anecdote because I was recently in the US, right? And I was in Washington, and I thought, I've got to go and look at the Australian Embassy, right? The new one, which Albanese opened in October 23, I think. And so I went down, had a look at the embassy, walked into the foyer, and what do you see, right? The first thing you see is a collection of burial poles from Arnhem Land, Yolngu people's burial poles. Then you look on the wall, you see Kevin Rudd's apology beautifully framed, a calligrapher has written it, and it's there on the wall. Then you look up and you see the Aboriginal flag, the Torres Strait Islander flag, and the Australian flag. And then along the walls, you can see Indigenous art. And it's so striking to me, you know.
Like, so there's no Tom Roberts.
No, not that I could see, but I mean, there may have been in other rooms, right, but that I couldn't see. But, I mean, it's so striking that you think to yourself, right, how do we project ourselves? What do we rely on? Who do we lean on when it comes to saying who we are as a people to others outside of the country? So often we rely on our Indigenous cultures, and yet somehow there's this disconnect, right, between the image we project, the symbols we use in the Washington Embassy, and probably many others, right, and there's that disconnect between that, right, and what we actually do here in the country, and how difficult it's been to actually genuinely, you know, not just have this ornamental symbolic use of it, but to actually change.
Well,
fundamental ways.
Yeah, people can entertain many different strands of the Aboriginal story in their head at the same
time. Yes.
This is the point. 1-300-800-222 is the number if you'd like to maybe ask a question of Mark or join the conversation. Mark McKenna is an historian and emeritus professor at Sydney University in the ANU, and his latest book is called The Shortest History of Australia, and we're chatting about it tonight. One of the other joys of the book is that you, as I say, you don't tell this chronological A to B story, but there's a whole lot of other corners of Australia which you explore. For example, Christmas Island.
Yeah, Christmas
now,
Island.
Christmas Island, of course, everyone knows about now because it's in the news.
That's right.
But,
yeah.
But as you say, it's part of Australia, and I guess most people couldn't tell you a thing about it.
I think that, well, firstly, you know, just a broad brush history of it. Christmas Island is annexed by the United Kingdom in 1888, and then it's basically handed over to Australia in 1958, right? It has this weird kind of situation where it's, you know, they vote in the Northern Territory electorate of Lingyari, right? They have a Western Australian postcode. They're governed under WA law. They've got Commonwealth funding. It's like, so you have to, and you leave when you leave Perth and fly to Christmas Island, you leave from the international terminal, not the domestic terminal, although this is part of Australia. So it's an you know, it exists in our heads, right? As most recently, obviously, for the detention centre and the whole ongoing, you know, drama, you know, which is about asylum seekers, refugees, etc. But, what I try to do is show the history of Christmas Island. It was a phosphate mine, and now it's sort of seen as everything from an eco haven to still the detention centre is still there, of course. Eco haven, new tourist, environmental tourism. Casinos have been there for high rollers from Asia and so on. So it's very hard for the island's population they constantly struggle to be seen as part of Australia. And that was a real issue for Australian governments after the war when Christmas Island became part of our territory. Because there was a lot of anxiety about the fact that a lot of the Asian workers who were working in the phosphate mines would become Australian citizens, right?
Yeah, yeah.
So it's very, So it's very, very interesting history to look at the parallel history of white Australia and look at it through Christmas Island. But, you know, part of the reason I wanted to mention Christmas Island in the book was because I'm doing that in a chapter called The Island Dilemma, And that Island Dilemma is familiar to you, and it's familiar to everyone, I think, who's listening. And that is the dilemma we've had in Australia about our geographical position, right? The fact that we are, you know, saw ourselves as removed from far from England, far away from Europe and the rest of the world, down here in the Asia Pacific. And there's two ways of looking at that, right? You know, some people, and you'll still hear this today, think our position is a source of security because we're so far from everything. And other people will say, well, as Richard Miles did recently, he's talking about Australia's relationship with China, saying, well, it's our major trading partner. At the same time, it's our major security threat. So our position, our geography is a source of vulnerability for, you know, at times. It's a source of anxiety, whether it be in the 19th century Chinese invasion or Japanese invasion or, you know, whether it be asylum seekers or whether it be the current threat of China, we are still grappling with this dilemma of how we respond to our geographical position, both politically with our foreign policy, as we were talking about earlier, but also emotionally. You know, like for me, and you know, I write about this, but one of the things that's amazing about this country is that we can so easily find places and beaches, not even more, much more than beaches, but where we can be the only person there.
Yeah.
And, you know, that is so much harder to do in the Northern Hemisphere and many other places in the Southern Hemisphere for that matter. So that's something that does give you an awareness of a kind of sense of removal from, you know, that you are far away. I mean, especially if you're in places and, like, imagine standing on a beach in the southern coast of Tasmania, right?
I have.
Right, yeah, okay. So, you know, that our responses aren't just, of course, political or economic to this dilemma. They are emotional, they're psychological. And you know, there's a great quote from Catherine Helen Spence that I use in the book, you know, who's so important in the history of female suffrage in Australia and South Australia and beyond, who when she went, she was born in Scotland, but she grew up in Adelaide from very early on. When she went back to the UK, she said, "I feel cribbed, I feel confined, right? I want those wide open spaces, right?"
We did think, so, we have thought that in Australia, that we were free of the old constraints, and yet we're strangely not, of course.
No.
Australians like to think of themselves as larrikins and egalitarians.
Yes, well, I mean, I think
is that deserved, do you think?
Well, in some ways not. I mean, I think that if you look at our attitude to government, we're quite obedient people.
We're very
so I wouldn't say, I think that that's, you know, the idea of ourselves as being, certainly the egalitarianism is there very, you know, in that idea of the fair go, right?
Yeah.
But, yeah, I mean, I think a lot of that is mythology more than fact, you know? Yeah.
John from French's Forest. G'day, John.
Oh, hi. Look, I just called in briefly about Australian history.
Yeah.
The Aboriginal existing here, as you said, for many tens of thousands of years. Something that popped up that I had a look at was a thing called, I think, called the Lapshore Excursion, which happened about 43,000 years ago. And the poles almost flipped. They went down to about 10% of what they are now. And according to the people that studied this, the aurora was seen almost to the equator. You could see it right across the country.
Right.
The Australian Aboriginals' religions based in the rainbow serpent appearing in the sky and making its way across the sky to create the land, the rivers, the valleys, and so on. If they witnessed this right across Australia, their religion is the oldest confirmed religion on the planet by 43,000 years. And it's never mentioned much that this religion is based in a real event that took place across Australia.
Very, very interesting, fascinating perspective. I mean, I think the interesting thing in that comment there is the word religion and whether, you know, that's the right word to describe Aboriginal spirituality and Aboriginal spiritual relationship with the land.
That's an interesting point, isn't it, that Aboriginal people don't have a religion in the sense that we have a religion, which is an optional belief system.
That's right. And so,
I mean, you can either choose to believe in your religion or not. That's the way we think.
Yeah.
But that's, I think, not what's the choice for Aboriginal people.
No, that's right. Not in the way we think of it, but I mean, but the point that the listener just raised about, you know, that the depth of that Indigenous knowledge, like in the book, for example, there's a great example of that where Scott Kane, the archaeologist who was responsible for a television series called First Footprints, right, realised that Aboriginal men, in this case, he was talking to in a pub about water, had knowledge of the water holes thousands of kilometres away from where they actually lived, as far away as Rottnest Island, you know. Where they had never been. And so that kind of knowledge of country, which is stretches beyond, through songlines, that knowledge stretches beyond the immediate point of habitation, you know, to encompass the whole continent. that is something I think we still are, you know, yet to really take on board.
Yeah. Well, this is Nightlife. We're talking to Mark McKenna, an historian, about his book, The Shortest History of Australia, and different ways of looking at our Australian history. Thanks for all the Aurora reports and photographs, by the way. Yes, we will talk about it. Don't worry. Dawn says, I'm in Woodend, Victoria. There's a huge white light across the southern horizon. Sue, no, I don't, we weren't suggesting that Aboriginal painting was a new form of art, as we mentioned, but the form it's represented on canvases is
that's
new.
Right.
Is new.
Yeah, that's right.
Robert from Hobart. G'day, Robert.
Yes, hello. This is Robert Cassidy. Hello, Mark and Phil.
Hi.
Hi.
And a fellow author, by the way. I'm calling in because I wanted to have you consider this, that history should be written in parallel research with archaeology. I would like to ask if you are aware that in Warrnambool, Victoria, obviously the southeast of the country, that there's a dig, an archaeological dig called the Moigil Archaeological Dig. And it dates human habitation as far back as 125,000 years. So it's a good possibility that our first peoples may actually have been the second peoples if the first peoples were here only 65,000 years. Do you understand my point?
Yeah,
I mean, they marched, they walked all the way across Sahul and then down across Papua New Guinea into the Northern Territories, migrated all the way down south, and then So I really think that history ought to be written in parallel with research into archaeology.
I think that's a really important point that you're making there. I agree that, and actually I've got a couple of Australian historian friends who are currently studying archaeology for that very reason. And can I add to that, the other thing that we need to study more is Indigenous languages. Yes to archaeology, but also yes to language.
Yeah, hear to that. Thanks, Robert. Yes, hear to that.
There's,
you know, one of the interesting things I've read in recent years was that arguments in the sense as to whether or not Aboriginal people practiced agriculture, for example, are relatively easily solved in a sense by going to the languages and saying, where are the words for these things?
Yes,
And, you know, most instances they can't be found.
And also look at the evidence on the ground
as well.
Fish traps, quarries, et cetera, et cetera.
Mark McKenna's with us. I love the way you puncture a few myths, including one that's been a pet dislike of mine, and that is that things were always crook and terrible and whiplashy and savage for our convict ancestors. I mean, maybe I'm trying to defend. Maybe I'm trying to defend my lot because we were convicts, both sides.
Sure,
but
right. Okay.
It wasn't actually. This is despite Robert Hughes's The Fatal Shore, which did a lot to,
cement the
image that the convicts, as soon as they arrived, had a savage and terrible time. It's more nuanced than that, isn't it? They didn't. Some of them didn't actually.
The history of flogging, you know, and Hughes documented this in extraordinary detail. The punishment was severe.
Yeah.
But I mean, overall, if you look at the history of convictism overall in Australia, you have to acknowledge the advantages for a convict are if they serve their time, you know. They did the right thing, in inverted commas. They could get a land, they had the capacity to get land grants. They could work after they had free time to work on their own time. So overall, their opportunities to advance economically were so much better than they would have been if they had.
Because there wasn't.
You know,
there wasn't,
even if they weren't imprisoned in the UK, if they weren't criminals. The capacity for economic advancement here was so much greater.
Because there wasn't much economic point in savagely beating them all the time, because after all, they were the colonies' major source.
They needed them.
Yeah.
And, of course, stories of, you know, extreme punishment, you know, convicts consuming one another or in the bush in Tasmania or all of these terrible stories we're familiar with, they're always much more dramatic than the stories of the majority who really, you know, served their time and really, you know, played such an important role in that founding period of Australia, of the, you know, modern Australia that we think of.
Yes, in the case of my ancestor, but, he arrived, did his time, got a ticket of leave, became a plasterer.
Yeah.
Guess what? Three generations later, they're still plasterers.
Right. Yeah. I mean, you know, the other thing is that it's really still quite recent that we've just got over that hang up about our convict history. So, you know, to remember that from the early 19th century right through till 1970s, just about, that Australia, that convict history was a source of embarrassment for Australia. And I think, you know, it's tied up with the Anzac thing as well, right? That one of the reasons the Anzac legend took on so strongly early on was because Australians of that, you know, Federation era were really keen to shed that sense of embarrassment over their convict origins and prove themselves to the UK. That was part of the explanation for the way it took hold, I think.
Yeah, that was particularly strong, wasn't it, around the turn of the last century?
It was. You know,
with Henry Lawson and people on the Sons of the South.
Sons of the South, yes.
That we were a new breed of people.
Yep.
You know, we were doughty and self-sufficient, and we didn't have the shackles of the old ways and the old land.
Yes, yeah, that's right.
And this was a new place.
Yeah,
and we'd forge new ideas.
That's right. Yeah, yeah.
So, sometimes we did.
We certainly did. Well, that's another thing that I try to get across in the book, you know, that if you go back to the 80s, you have people like Manning Clark, huge figure, who I've, of course, written his biography. But, you know, he would often say in public, for example, when he was talking about Australia's relationship with Britain, that, hey, you know, we were colonials. We didn't make our own history, right, because we were British, right? But, of course, nothing could be further from the truth.
Yeah, you know, we did.
We did make our own history, despite the fact that we were, you know, a British colony.
We're still making it.
Or colonies.
We're still making it. Mark, terrific conversation, like all good conversations. Time flies and we're out of it. But if you want to hear more, we'll put this conversation up as a podcast on our site. So I'll tell you how to find that in a moment. And the book is out at the moment in shops, The Shortest History of Australia. Mark McKenna has been our guest, and check that out as well. Mark, appreciate your time. Thank you.
It was nice to be with you, Philip. Thanks.
Mark McKenna.
You've been listening to a Nightlife podcast. For more great conversations about the issues that impact you, as well as features on travel and food, head to the Nightlife webpage. You'll find it at abc.net.au/nightlife. You don't need to be a night owl to enjoy the nightlife.